the thing that I find the most useful about like these models in general is like when I have this big spreadsheets of a lot of results and I just need to make plots of it. I think models can quite good do the screenshot and make a plot of this. I hate making this matplotlib stuff about. It's so annoying. There were so many moments this year where AI suddenly crossed that like that immersion thing. So I think AI coding is one of them, like we just discussed. I think like Nano Banana also got to the point where I usually like, if you make these images, it's just like doing it for fun, you just troll your friend or something like that. But like Nano Banana actually really got so good.
Welcome back.
Yeah.
How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm good. Great to be back.
It's been one and a half years.
Yeah, it's been 1.5 months.
Feels like a long time. So last time we talked, you were at Reka.
Yeah.
And then you joined GDM again, working for Quark again.
Yeah.
And more recently, you've started GDM Singapore.
Yeah.
Oh, is it GDM Singapore or Gemini Singapore? I don't know if you've named the team.
I think we have a Gemini team in Singapore. Yeah.
Gemini team in Singapore. And it's called Reasoning and AGI.
Yeah, Reasoning and AGI.
Is it important to have AGI in the name?
It was like a white thing that we put AGI in. I think that like one reason why we work on these models is that we want to get to AGI. And I just was a vibe thing that we added the AGI to the job posting. Yeah. There is no like formal name of the team yet. But it's basically the Gemini team Singapore. Yeah.
I mean, I think people are like trying to triangulate. Amazon has an AGI team. You guys have an AGI team. And then let's say Meta now has a super intelligence team. What are people signaling when they choose these names for their teams? Do they have, we have a plan? Or is it just vibes?
You try to fish some hot takes from this.
No. You have officially AGI in your job title?
No, it's not a team name. It's not a team name. Yeah. Yeah, it's just, you know, we just want to signal the North Star of we're building this model to get to AGI.
Yeah. No, I wasn't really fishing for hot takes. Okay, so you rejoined GDM.
Yeah.
And I think last time we talked about, I listened back to the whole thing. It was an amazing episode last time. You were talking about how it's like externally, were in Brain and came out and now you're back in GDM.
Yeah.
I wonder what's your general reflections just plugging back into the Google infrastructure.
Oh, yeah. So I guess coming back, it's very interesting because it felt and return to Google, like everything, including your LDAP, your username is all the same. It's like you play Pokemon, you leave it aside and then you go back and you click continue.
It's a save game.
Yeah, you save game and continue game. It's like that. Obviously, the last 1.5 years, while I was away, many things have changed. Brain is now part of GDM and stuff. So I think that obviously a lot of things have changed, but I think overall the coming back has been pretty seamless. Obviously, I love Google infrastructure and I think DBUs are great and stuff like that. Yeah, and I'm very glad to be back to Google Infra. Yeah.
And was the intention always that you were going to work on DeepThink?
No, not really. I think I miss research a lot, like doing like research. Not like super fundamental research, but like close to model research, right? But I really miss being at the frontier and trying to go beyond that, right? So I really miss that a lot. And I think when I came back, DeepThink wasn't a thing. And I don't think there was any plans, actually. It was just like, I'm just going to work on research and see what happens, yeah.
But I'm sure, I guess, there was some inclination that reasoning is the next frontier. And that's like obviously the most rewarding research path, especially this year.
Yeah, I think reasoning, these days reasoning and RL is like probably quite, it's RL reasoning comes. I spent a lot of my past life, I call it the past art, working on like architectures and pre-training. But I think now I transition more into RL research. I'm not like old school RL, but the Gaines RL and the old school RL. And to be honest, I had almost no RL background coming back. But I think like RL is the main means of modeling these days. And yeah, so I think it was pretty easy to jump back in. And I think a lot of fundamental skills in research is general purpose and universal. And it's quite easy to innovate, even in a tool set that you're not super used to. And yeah, so I think RL is basically the main modeling tool set that we play around with these days.
Superficially, I see some, you know, in your UL2 and T5 work, some overlap of like, you know, the focus on objectives and the focus on the stuff that you're trying to incentivize. So I would have maybe guessed there was more overlap than you're saying right now, which is interesting. But I know, I understand it's very super
objective is objective and they have some like overlap, right? Yeah, I think it's just mainly like on policy and off policiness of designing these things that change how like also the learning algorithm itself, right?
Let's just introduce this kind of terminology to people if they're not that familiar with the sort of RL policy. I do think that a lot of people are like trying to understand what is working about this generation of RL research. Anyway, so Jason had this interesting post, which I think you were co-signing, which is basically you always want to be on policy. Instead of mimicking other people's successful trajectories, take your own actions and learn from the reward given by the environment. Basically, correct your own path instead of trying to imitate other people's path.
Yeah, yeah.
And first of all, he writes really well and I wish that more people wrote like him. But I don't know, what's your reflection on that or your addition on top of that?
Yeah, so I think like the biggest analogy of the on policy and off policy is basically like off policy is basically like when you SFT something, it's off policy. Basically, you take some other model, larger model stuff, and then it's basically like there's off policy, somebody else's generated outputs, trajectories, and whatever. I think on policy is mainly like the core idea of like modern LMRL, where you like generate and then you reward the model based on its own generations, and then the model trains on its own generations.
Yeah.
So it's more, it's a bit like self-distillation to some extent. The model generates its own output and then you reward it and then trains on its own output. So I think on-policiness is basically this idea of like model training on its own outputs and letting the model like generate its own trajectories and then letting some reward verify it and then the model train its own outputs. I think this is more generalizable in general. I think there's still a lot of like science out and still to be done about the gap between SFT and RL itself. But I think basically on policy and off policy, right? And I think bring this analogy back to real like life. I mean, this on policiness is more like humans, we are more on policy because we go around the world, we make mistakes and then we are, okay, this is, but like imitation learning is supposed to be somebody else.
Not first principle.
It just tells you what to do and then you just copy. Yeah. So I think, yeah, this philosophy, bringing back this philosophy to life is quite like powerful. Like when I, like now I have a kid and everything, like I want my kid to try stuff and then you tell them like, okay, this is like where this went wrong, where this went right and stuff, rather than, okay, you just copy everything somebody else does.
Yeah, there's a Montessori schooling is mostly that, right? Like very unstructured learning, like you discover your own path and we just give you a safe environment to do it.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
What is the point at which you should transition from imitation to on policy?
I do bounce back and forth.
For humans, right? Not models, right?
I would say in models, it seems like there mostly has been a very concrete, like, first you imitate, and that's pre-training. And then you RL at the end.
Technically, SFT is still imitation. But I think for humans, it's also a little bit of this, right? Because if you basically, like, it's like sports, right? When you play sports, you start off by imitating, like, hardcore imitating. But then you cannot imitate forever because you need to, like, imitation, I don't know whether this is a good analogy, but watching a lot of tutorials and stuff is more like imitating. You learn, try to learn certain movements and stuff like that. But then, like, on-policiness is, like, going to the game itself and trying to get a reward signal from that, right? But so I think that humans do need some form of imitation learning, but, like, I think everybody starts off by imitating. But then again, the human and model kind of is not, it's just fun to have analogies, but we shouldn't like take things like super literally and stuff like that.
I actually am quite a serious taker of machine learning insights into human learning.
So we learn from models now?
Yeah. Because I think like machine learning is the most scientific way we have ever studied learning, just in general.
That's true, that's true.
Where we had to invent curriculum from like scratch.
Yeah, that's true.
And things like learning rate. If your learning rate is too high, blah, blah, blah. Learning rate is too low, blah, blah.
Like, wait, do humans even have a learning rate?
So I do tell people to keep an idea of their own learning rate and to be wary of it being too low. So for example, if you've been wrong once, you should ask, where else have I been wrong? And typically, usually, let's say learning.
Oh, okay.
You know what I mean? People usually update slower than they should when they have been wrong.
Wait, is it stubbornness?
It could be stubbornness. I don't know. Is that the right word for it? It could be like they're too Bayesian when actually it's like their prior assumptions are wrong and they need to completely throw out their previous assumptions because one counter example invalidates all prior experience. Your entire world model is wrong. Throw it away. So Bayesian actually wrong. Let's say you've lived for 10 years under some assumptions and you have one example that breaks your narrative.
Okay.
You shouldn't be like, okay, now I have 2% update. No, actually it should be like, oh, like something's really freaking changed. Everything I've assumed for the last 10 years is probably wrong. What else am I wrong in? And update 20%, update 50%, not 2%. You know what I mean? That's a learning rate thing for me. So my direct example is the whole getting into AI stuff. I was watching GANs for 10 years.
Yeah.
Has it been 10 years? 2012, 2013?
Time flies, yeah.
I was watching GANs and I was like, okay, this is cool. It's getting more detail. Not that impressive. Then all of a sudden, Stable Diffusion came out. And you can run it on your laptop. And that was my learning rate. Okay, like, fuck. Like, my mental model of generative images did not include this. And so I was like, okay, like I am very wrong and I need to pivot everything. And that's how I started Later Space.
So would this mean that like your learning rate is high?
Yes, I will nudge it up. I schedule my learning rates because a role model has been violated.
Okay, I think it's a good strategy. I think also this brings a little bit to like when new paradigms happen, like how fast people are to adopt it or like to invalidate their understanding of things. I think as scientists, we definitely, a lot of times we do have to keep, as the field progress, we do have to keep like invalidating our own role model. It could be like a certain way, the way to do like something all along and suddenly something comes along and invalidates it. Yeah.
Yeah, you can be very proud of your priors until it's like becomes your prison.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, yeah.
That is like actually very dangerous.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, that was a bit of a tangent. Oh, I don't know how we got there. You did highlight Denny's LLM reasoning lectures where he got to trace the intellectual history of reasoning in LLMs.
Yeah.
Chain of thought to now RLFT. And then the one part that I was going to prompt you a little bit was also self-consistency, right?
Which
I think people roughly know. I think it's more crudely implemented with OpenAI than with you guys, where it is straight up, they have 8 inferences and they judge or whatever. But I do think that also is relevant to on-policy distillation, where it's like literally you have 8 different paths and they're all from the same model. I'm checking my intuition there. Basically, the stuff that you're saying about why on-policy is important and using, let's say, an external verifier to improve your reasoning, you can also do that with parallel reasoning.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like when we train RL models, they sample multiple times. So yeah, to some extent, there's some form of self-consistency.
Is that directly? That's self-consistency, right?
Yeah, self-consistency is a little bit more, it's the more normal version of, if you talk to Danny, Hotel, it's not majority voting for sure, but it's more...
I agree.
Yeah, it's more nuanced version of that. But I think parallel thinking definitely is related to self-consistency. Yeah.
Yeah. I think for those people, OpenAI also actually put out some interesting papers on majority voting versus other forms of like, multiple output consensus. Then basically, like you, at the highest level is an actual LLM judge that decides. Like this is actually a worthwhile trajectory that is more valid based on some internal consistency or just like inspecting the chain of thought, which is kind of very cool that we can train models to do that.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
yeah. Self-consistency is a big fundamental idea. I mean, chain of thought itself was also a big idea, and then self-consistency was also like a big fundamental idea in modern like LLM literature.
Yeah, amazing. Okay, so let's bring it to, I guess, one of the headlines of this podcast is going to be about diving into the IMO world.
Yeah.
So this was around about July. You guys announced, this very nice photo here. This is the photo I was looking at. This is in London, I believe, where you had Dishoom.
Yeah, Dishoom. Yeah. you got to be at a photo taking to get the credit.
That's bullshit, right? What the fuck?
No, I'm just kidding.
Like, the contributor list is bigger than this.
Yeah, but like they were like saying like, oh, like okay, you should go to the photo.
In order to get a literal gold medal?
No. Oh. Like to get the credit for being the IMO. Emphasis to be hit in the photo. So it's just a joke. It's just a joke. Yeah.
But anyway, okay, could you tell the story of studying this IMO thing? Apparently it was done in 1 week.
So let me like be a bit more clarified a lot of things, right? So the IMO effort has been like very long standing. So Tang and Kuo has been really working on this, like, even last year, right? Last year they got, like, I was not back at Google at the time, but like they had the alpha geometry stuff and then they were like alpha proof and stuff. So it's a very long standing effort. But I think this year was we wanted to try to like use Gemini as an end-to-end model, basically. No second system.
Like,
that affects in, text out.
Yes.
Like, a model. And
even that was a not intuitive thing. I covered the silver result from last year.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, it's pretty close. Like, it's 1 point off from the silver. Just try a bit harder, you'll get gold. That decision to abandon it, I think it was pretty bold. I don't know.
I personally always believe in, if you're not, like, in retrospect, it's easy to say this, but it's a bit like, if the model can't get to IMO goal, then can we get to AGI? Basically, so it's basically at some point we have to use these models to try this Olympic competitions. And I think that one of the goals this year was like, okay, we're going to do an end-to-end like text out model. That's where like my involvement came in. So basically I was not like involved in the IMO effort only until the model training part. So I have to say that Tang did most of the IMO thing. I just trained the model with a bunch of
What does that work involve? What does something
so basically we just prepared the model checkpoint for the actual IMO itself, right? So there's also something that's easily overlooked about the IMO thing was that many times you want to chase benchmarks or stuff like that. It's always like thing that you can kind of keep running and running and hill climbing until you get there, and then you did. But like the IMO was a live competition. Like some members of the team were in Australia for the thing, and there was like this happening thing was happening live, was unfolding live.
Oh, it's a very alpha goal. You receive the thing, you like punch it into your system, and then you, like,
yeah. So like some of the professors from Kang's team were like in when they went to the IMO itself and stuff like that. The conference, I don't even know whether IMO is a conference, but it feels like there were people there. Like in Australia. And then, so it was a live thing, and there were people who actually, the job was to run inference on this IMO P1, the P6 that came out. And they also came out on like different days. So it's like different sets, like one day two, something like that. So the fun part is that I knew nothing about IMO like at all. I'm not like a kid that took part in IMO. Like I was too dumb for that.
You're a piano player.
And yeah, I have a bit of piano, but what I only knew was that, okay, we delivered the checkpoint and that checkpoint was used to do the IMO goal. But then, like, there was somehow a week in London where everybody gathered there. So everybody was flying to London and then this photo was taken there. And then you get to see how all the different parts, like, come together. And, like, also being in the other rooms, in the rooms with the other, like, co-captains. And then it felt a little bit like a hackathon thing. So, yeah, I think this was, like, the training process of this IMO model itself was like maybe a week or so. Not the actual, like the whole, like basically. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
I think that the question is, I'm still not over the decision to throw away Alpha Proof.
Okay. Yeah.
Basically, I think it's very major. And I understand that you have this goal of AGI. Obviously, like at some point, one model should do it to do all of it. Right. Yeah. But I think if you pointed a gun at me and said in 2024, what do you need is to do IMO and IOI and CPC and all the other stuff that you guys did, was you need an LLM reasoning system that knows how to operate a computer and knows how to write lean and run lean verifier and all these. But basically, you ROFT the lean verifier into the chain of thought. Is that the...
Wait,
So basically, like, it is not obvious that you can do that at all. Because I think...
So what you mean is that, like, in some way,
you need a system one system to be
encoded in you need parameters of the model somehow.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's just whether at the end of the day you just believe in like this like connection is one model loss of parameter. I mean, there's also two use, right? There's also two use, which, you know, and stuff like that. But I think to some extent the model I think we should be able to get to a point where, in the past, when the LLM first started, the model couldn't even be a calculator. Now it can somewhat be a calculator. So technically, like a tool like a calculator is somewhat encoded in the parameters of the model. So I think we will eventually get a point where whether there's things that cannot be expressed in the parameters of the model is like an open question. We don't know where's that limit, but I think we will keep pushing and pushing this limit. So whether like something like a lean system or like some other things to solve other like maybe a physics engine or something where we still continue to push that boundary. Yeah. But I actually don't know like whether there were a lot of debates about symbolic system versus
Android. Yes, that's the word I was training.
I actually don't really know whether there was like, to me, I was just like, oh, let's train the model. And then someone told me to train the model and then I trained the model. Basically, there was like overarching like the IMO effort that decided this. And I also think that because these specialized systems are very like one-off systems that are like, you could create like a chemistry engine, you create a math engine, you could create the thing, right? But at the end of the day, you want one model for everything. So
yeah.
So I think this kind of fits that direction a little bit more, where you have one model for, and then this model was also like launched as Gemini Deep Thing, as a general purpose Gemini Deep Thing. So
it's basically unchanged, but with maybe some config toned down a bit.
Yeah. So the inference time config was like the one served to most people is different, but the full IMO inference config was shipped to some mathematicians just because of the inference cost, right? But that was good enough to be a general purpose model. I think my take is that this intuition was what led to the trying to go towards one model instead of, because this specialized systems, there's no end, right? You can create many specialized systems.
Yes.
The most I can see in the future is there'll be a model then there's something that really cannot be subsumed by a model. Then you just use a tool or something like that.
Yeah.
Right. But my prediction is that like, I think most things can be subsumed by the model. I think, yeah. AI researchers are quite good at hill climbing.
History would say that you have a lot of evidence backing you up. Is this the model output? that this is it, right? This is what.
Yeah, I think this is the model output. Yeah.
And what do you see when you look at this? You just see, obviously, it looks like a well-written prompt. It looks like something a real human mathematician would do. People did compare yours versus the OpenAI one, where OpenAI is a lot more raw, or they have to clean up their versions. We don't have to talk about OpenAI, but I think what is interesting to you when you saw this kind of output?
I want to give a little bit like a special disclaimer is that I know nothing about AI. Right. So I think the wonderful thing about this era of LLM is that like you can be a AI researcher, engineer, and you don't have any domain knowledge, and you can still get a gold medal.
It's a universal tool
that you don't know anything about. I can't pass this at all. This is foreign to me.
But maybe a proof is a particular kind of chain of thought. But yeah. I would say that the other interesting thing that some of your collaborators were talking about, he was like, oh, this is the first example of reasoning in a non-verifiable domain, which to me isn't proof by definition verifiable. I just want to give you things to riff on or debates that might be worth digging into.
So I think that's good. There's a lot of, aside from proofs, there's a lot of domains that are like non-verifiable, and I think not easy to verify. So it's like, when people mean non-verifiable, it's like non-trivial to verify, or like just not as easy as like the solution of like a math problem, because proofs are long form, and it's also, that's why it's non-trivial to verify unless you convert it to lean and then you do all kinds of things, right? So I think there's a lot of work to be done in like this type of non-verifiable domains. Yeah, I'm getting into this territory where I'm not sure what I can say or what I cannot say.
Okay, so that's it. I think another thing that is an open topic of debate was how much domain-specific work or post-training was done, because you then went on to do the IOI and CPC stuff as well, right? The same model.
I was not directly involved in the ICPC, but I was related to some extent. That's all I can say, yeah.
Yeah. Any other interesting call-outs? Maybe just on the team. You called out Jonathan as someone who is co-captain on this effort. And yeah, basically, how does the effort come together?
So I think there were four captains for the IMO, two from London. Jonathan was from Mountain View. I was from Singapore. So I think four of us basically trained this model together. And I think one, also trying to see what Tang was saying. But I think one interesting thing was that like we're all in different time zones and we're all... And there's something also very interesting about like passing on the job. There's no like really like fixed workflow how to work together between captains. So it's more like, oh, I'm going to board the plane now. I'll be like AFK for 12 hours. So someone take care.
So you're just babysitting the run.
Sometimes there are bugs and stuff. The job comes down sometimes. So basically it's very ad hoc and it's really between the captains how we decide to like work together. And yeah, but I think it was a kind of interesting time also because we were all flying. Like I think the London folks were not having to fly, but I had to fly and Jonathan had to fly. And then like when you visit another country, you have another, like if you visit another office, you have many meetings. So I was in and out meetings and it was a pretty like interesting. And I also think that nobody really knew whether we would get go at that time because the IMO actually hasn't happened. But yeah, it was interesting and exciting. And then I think like the whole process of this getting verified by the IMO committee and there was like, okay, but we're not going there. But I had to learn a lot about how the IMO works, right? Apparently the goal score is not even a fixed number. It's like a bell curve, right? Yeah. So it was like a time where you just look at the score, you're like I was even like looking at watching the human participants and then seeing like what their scores were, because whether Gemini will get gold depends on like how the humans do. So you're like looking at, oh, if a certain percentage, you're like, what's the do we get gold?
To some extent, you don't have any control over that. So
but you're just curious, right? Because so I would say that it's definitely more exciting. Like there's more adrenaline than like just running on a benchmark and getting a number. It was like a process that took some time. Yeah. But I think overall, if you have specific questions, you can ask also. But I think this whole thing has been a highlight for me. This IMO effort has been...
I would say most people, if you ask them maybe 2 years ago whether a model could get an IMO goal, they would have said it's like impossible. Then the silver helped, right, from last year. But like the fact that you can throw that system completely away and then just take existing Gemini and scale up DeepThink, and then just running for IMO gold, I think it's also like very non-consensus compared to last year.
Yeah, definitely. To some extent, I think researchers were also surprised. I wouldn't say like surprised, but like it was more like a pat on the back kind of surprise. Oh, we actually made a lot of progress we as in collectively, all the engineers and researchers working on Gemini. There's a lot of progress being made. Let's look at how much we went in 1 year. Yeah. And I also think that it's just 5 years ago, right? Not 2 years, like 5 years, you just imagine the outcome. Like, you just look at the state of AI now, like, just generally, the IMO and the ICPC go, and like also even like things like Nano Banana. If you just look at the AI progress now and 5 years ago, I think people would think that we already reached like AGI.
Some form of AGI.
Some form of AGI. Yeah.
We're just moving.
If you just travel, like, you take these checkpoints and you travel back into 5 years ago, someone should make a drama about this. But I think it's really quite impressive, like, how the field has moved so quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
The hard parts, you would say, were scaling inference.
In what aspect? Like, hard in terms of, like, even expensive?
Hard as in maybe the most amount of brain power expended on the team. I saw some comments where they were like, actually, the hardest part was the inference optimization, or like the very, very long horizon inference that deep thing needed compared to normal Gemini, stuff like that.
I didn't work on the inference time scaling. So I wouldn't know. Yeah.
That is mostly that. Oh, and then there was this, the code name was apparently IMO Cat, which you named after your desk.
Okay, that's not really, like, it was in the, so I think I tweeted about it at some point, right? Like,
yeah.
Bring up the tweet. So the IM Cat was basically like, okay, it's not like an official code name or something. It's just like the name that the config of the job was, like, IM Cat. That's the...
You just need some kind of name.
Yeah, I mean, I just like, you know, I like cats, and then, yeah.
Yeah, so. Fair enough. That is mostly it on IMO, unless you want to bring up anything else. We have other sort of researchy topics, but before I go into sort of researchy topics, I did want to maybe leave the floor to cover what else should people know about the reasoning effort that's going on at GDM.
Let me think of where to start this. What do people need to know? The model is really good, yeah. But that's what people need.
Maybe an easy one to start with would be, a lot of people were focusing on maybe academic benchmarks 2 years ago. Last year, maybe LM Arena. This year, Pokemon. Pokemon is very interesting reasoning, visual reasoning, and just general long horizon agent planning benchmark. And I don't know, you seem to focus on it a lot. And I think Gemini did it very well. So obviously, I think it's something that is easy to talk about.
I think I probably should be listening to this. There's actually nothing specifically done for Pokemon.
Of course.
Yeah, of course. Like, there's nothing specifically done for Pokemon. And I think Logan had this tweet recently about the recent Gemini 3 on Pokemon Crystal. Mm. And Pokemon Crystal is like,
it was so much more efficient.
Yeah. I think Pokemon is like, so I used to play a lot of Pokemon, and I'm a big Pokemon fan in general. And I think it's a great, like you say, it's a great long horizon benchmark and stuff like that. And I think it's good to check in once in a while on these benchmarks that like almost never get contaminated, or like people actually like don't spend time to
benchmarks.
Like, you climb benchmarks. It's like kind of silly to like, people are like, okay, like, what are you working on? If some people are like, oh, I'm working on Amy, I'm working on HLE, I'm working on Pokemon maxing or something like that. That's kind of like funny.
We did interview the cloud-based Pokemon AI. I think his name is David. And it showed serious flaws in Anthropic's screen understanding vision capabilities.
Yeah.
Couldn't tell. I'm trying to like get past this wall, but you keep running into it. Because it doesn't know that the wall is there. And so it doesn't have any spatial reasoning at all.
I mean, some of it could be like a harness, like the harness thing, or like also whether the model has access to like game state information, or is it completely visual?
Yeah, Claude's implementation is very game state heavy. They dumped effectively like all the memory of what's going on in the emulator.
Yeah, I see.
Yeah.
I don't know whether I'm jumping off tangent or something like that. So I think solving Pokemon is going to be more of like how fast you solve it. And then like the thing that I have not really seen so far is like whether the model can complete the Pokedex.
Why is that? It's more challenging.
No, but complete the Pokedex is so hard. Right? You need to plan. You need to search up like information. Like there's some things if you don't like go online. Basically, you need to like have a little bit of deep research in this.
Yeah.
The model will just never know like that it needs to trade, okay? If it's able to go online, post on forums, and then find someone to, like, hey, cool, can I trade with you? Is Pokemon to evolve? Some Pokemon needs to be traded to evolve.
Yes, or mated.
But anyway, I don't know. I have not seen the model be able to complete the Pokedex. But complete the Pokedex is really hard, actually, for models. So I think that's actually an interesting, an interesting one, yeah.
Yeah, I wonder what the real world analogy would be if we have a model that is capable of doing that, what can we make it do that we cannot do today?
But there's a lot of planning involved.
Like
right?
Just real deep research.
Like planning, there's also a lot of planning involved. And it's more, I think completely Pokemon, the Pokemon game is very linear, right? I think the Pokedex involves a lot of like
backtracking. research.
Yeah, a lot of research and a lot of, yeah. So it's probably a different nature itself.
Is that as interesting to you as, for example, a lot of other people in the AI for science world are trying to discover things that you cannot look up, right?
Novel knowledge.
Yeah, novel knowledge. Because basically what you're saying is we're not even there yet. We're at the place where models cannot consistently apply knowledge that they look up, right? Like you give Gemini access to a web search and you say, okay, come try to collect all the Pokemon in a Pokedex. You don't have high confidence that it will do it. I don't know if someone's actually tried. Probably no, right?
No, I think the hard part is actually like trying to use the, like synthesize the web knowledge and then apply it in the game itself with all that visual state going on and stuff. Like, it probably will be solved in one or two.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not...
It is challenging.
It's not challenging, but like, not like super...
Is it interesting? Like you're basically just... the task really is, can you look up the guide to do it? And then can you apply the guide? That's it. You know what's even more intelligent than that? Creating the guide. Like being the first to figure out how to create the guide. Which is what in...
Oh, yeah, yeah. But then when it comes to this study, it's mostly that's an exhaustive search thing. I'm also just try and try, like humans and guide for that. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so that's actually less interesting to you. Interesting.
Okay, actually to be... Okay, when you think about it, it's like not super, super interesting, but it's okay. It's just like I have not seen a model to try to do this. So it's
yeah.
Just like...
Yeah, I think like efficient search of a novel idea space is interesting. Obviously, you can brute force anything, but we're not talking about brute forcing. We're talking about trying to create an AI scientist.
But novel knowledge is actually an interesting thing that I think is going to be... quite a big thing, being able to generate novel.
Google has done stuff there, which I don't... you're probably not that close to those teams that has done AI scientist work.
There's some things that have been... It's like, for example, if you freeze the model weights at like 2015, you freeze time at 2015, and then you, even with the current model, let's say you have... Okay, let's assume there's no leaking of information somehow. If you ask the model what's the best ML, okay, not 2015, like 2012 or something, it will just tell you like SVMs are like the best, right? This is the way that machine learning works in general, right? And the question is, can it invent the transformer, right? It might not be able to, like even today models, they might not even be able to invent the transformer. Like if you freeze the time at a certain time and even you bring the time, I mean, the model is a transformer, so I just say there's no, assuming there's no leakage, that's
No, totally possible. Yeah.
Like, so I think there's still a lot of open questions about like whether the model can really, you know, innovate and generate like really novel knowledge, yeah.
Yeah, one related question on that, which I think is related to the Denny paper, which is I think people have this sort of mythicism on what reasoning is. And reasoning, if you really demystify it a lot, it's whatever happens inside the chain of thought tags, right? And you're eliciting that reasoning behavior from some stuff that is already latent inside of the pre-trained corpus. Is that that's one version of this interpretation?
I think these days, like reasoning itself is very vague and it's very open. So it's like mostly different people will have different definitions of what reasoning is, right? So I agree that like this chain of thought is like basically when people think of reasoning, they associate with chain of thought and obviously it's what happens in the thinking and the, okay, reasoning, right? But I think these days it's more like I said in earlier, but it's like reasoning and RL is almost like this, like basically it's anything that is like post-training to elicit capabilities, basically. It's like RL and post-training to elicit capabilities. So I think the actual like technical definition of reasoning is making models better with thinking and post-training.
Okay.
Yeah. So basically like RLing the model to think better, right? And thinking is more like thinking traces and thought trajectories and stuff like that, right? There's also this line of work for latent thinking and stuff like that, like whether latent thinking and discrete token thinking is like going to be the same thing or like something like that. It's like an open question.
Meaning adding extra tokens to your vocab that represent
all... There's all these, I forgot what's the name, like these academic papers that do these loopy things or...
Track token.
Or like, they basically, instead of decoding discrete tokens, you actually simulate this by doing this in latent space, right?
Uh-huh.
So when you do chain of thought thinking and like reasoning, you basically decode extra tokens, hide it in the thinking tag, and then you decode stuff. But like latent thinking is basically you just don't decode tokens, you just
don't bother
by it.
It might start speaking... The native language of thinking is numbers, not passing it through some filter of English. And sometimes you might start thinking Chinese or something else.
Yeah, yeah. Generally, I don't really believe that model thoughts have to be the same with human thoughts. I'm actually, generally in ML, I'm more of the school of thought of let the model do whatever it wants in general.
There was a discussion, there's a latent representation hypothesis paper that I think you're maybe sympathetic to if you haven't already read it. to me, sounds obvious. Basically, image models will have the same idea what a laptop is versus a text model will have. They'll converge on like the same latent.
Yeah.
And obviously, you can align them and you can do all those stuff with them. And so it totally makes sense that their concept would be just a vector of numbers that represents laptop. That's the concept.
Yeah, yeah.
And okay, maybe you have some numerical differences between one model's idea what a laptop is versus another, but it mostly would be the same. Yeah, very interesting. The question I was kind of leading into was that because there's now we're in this age where LLM text is in the corpus of like stuff that we train on, where it's a little bit of a recursive loop, right? Like the reasoning tokens are out there now. And so pre-trained models themselves, pre-trained base models are also capable of reasoning. And they're increasingly so as more and more reasoning text goes into the corpus. Isn't that interesting or is that worrying?
Do you actually see much reasoning trace on the internet?
So
I've never seen those though.
I would say that...
Like on Hugging Face?
Yeah, people are publishing that specifically. As to whether or not people, researchers are actually including that in their training corpuses, who knows, right? Like that's their choice. But I would say that percentage on Common Crawl that has COT tokens in there went from 0 to 0.001%. Mm-hmm. And it will just go up over time because like people are publishing it.
Yeah, but I think if the sources are like quite clear, you can actually like filter away those because usually people put it on GitHub or put it on...
Do you want to filter it? Maybe you don't.
There's a choice for the...
Yeah, quite literally. The whole reason why... I don't think we covered this in our previous pod, but 2 years ago, a lot of people were like, oh, you just include more coding tokens in your pre-trained corpus.
Coding tokens are different from like coding tokens.
It generalizes outside of code for reasoning.
Oh, there was like...
You don't believe that?
No. As in like, I don't know if it's still true today, but
I see. Yeah, that was just our general coverage of reasoning. I would say that there's a lot of interesting work here and more to do. Maybe I'll cover one thing which I know that you have personal inputs on, which is that you have started using AI coding.
Oh yeah, so I actually don't really use much AI coding in the past, but I think we've reached a point where AI coding has started to become really useful. Like, okay, so before AI coding, the thing that I find the most useful about like these models in general is like when I have these big spreadsheets of a lot of results and I just need to make plots of it. I think models can quite good screenshot and make a plot of this. I hate making this matplotlib stuff about. It's so annoying. Okay, but that's basically like one thing that I can remember about like how I use AI in the past. But I think AI coding has started to become the point where I run a job, I get a bug. I almost don't look at the bug. I paste it into like anti-gravity and like I told it that would fix the bug for me and then I relaunched the job that like beyond like vibe coding it's more like vibe
training
vibe ML or something like that. I would say it does pretty well most of the time and it's actually there are classes of problems that it's just generally I know this is actually really good for and in fact maybe probably better than like I would have to spend like 20 minutes to find like figure out the issue and then fix the thing and then relaunch.
So yeah, that's very interesting because I would say like level one vibe coding is you actually know what to do, you're just too lazy.
Yeah,
it's just just do it for me, like I've done this 1,000 times, like just go fix it, like I know exactly what to do. Here you're saying it's like the next level where you actually don't even know, it's investigating it for you. As long as like the answer looks right, you'll just strip it.
At the start, I was a bit like, I did check it, look at the thing. And then at some point, I'm like, okay, maybe the model looks better than me. So I'm just going to let it do its stuff. And then I relaunch the job based on the fix that the model gave me. And I think the models will just keep getting better and better.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's something that. But I also think that, I mean, recently there's anti-gravity. I think also because these tools were not like that, in Google infrastructure, it's not that easy to... I'm not that familiar with what is available outside. And when I was in the startup, I think the models were not like so good like 1.5 years ago. So it's also like a forcing function that like it's also people are like, oh, try anti-gravity, it's a game changer and stuff. And like, okay, so I just started using and yeah.
Yeah, you spent some time with Varun recently.
I really did say hi and green. Okay.
I guess you were telling me that you're an AI researcher that doesn't even use much AI. And like now you're actually like AI pilled as a user.
There were so many moments this year where AI suddenly crossed that like that emergent thing. So I think AI coding is one of them like we just discussed. I think like Nano Banana also got to the point where I usually like if you make these images, it's just like a little for fun, you just troll your friend or something like that. But like Nano Banana actually really got so good that
you can use it for charts.
that you can use it for, like, basically, yeah. So it's getting really good. And I think, yeah, this year, the stuff, like, and even things like the past, many of these LMs will, like, hallucinate things a lot. But now, I just trust it, like, automatically. I think people are just enjoying the utility by these models. So now I'm like, I was always AI fuel. Like, AI is a good thing. Like, I don't see how anybody can disagree with that. But
yeah, but you are actually using it for things that you are high expertise in, which is your own ML work.
Yeah.
And just to confirm, do you have a special version of Gemini that you use internally that we don't have access to, or it's like public Gemini?
I think it's the public Gemini.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was just saying, like, it would be entirely reasonable to train Gemini internal for only your code base and your work.
Oh, actually, I'm not sure though. You see, these things are just like
straight away for me.
Yeah.
But obviously, if it improves your productivity by, I don't know, 10%, yeah, worth it, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's interesting. And there's the interesting thing, levels of how much do you trust it? How much of your jobs do you automate away
that
you no longer need? There's also the question, I guess, about how people come up and train in the field if you no longer need juniors. Because the Gemini is your junior ML researcher. So I think these are all interesting questions.
I want to say one quick thing first, right? So I think that when it comes to, like, whether a model can be a junior suite or, like, something like that, right? So I think if you think of it this way, if a job from a 1x suite, 1x suite, can be replaced by a model itself. But let's say you're a manager, right? The objective, that the metric you track is, like, your time. And then if you can have a model that saves you, like, the same amount of time as the work that your reports do, but you don't actually, like, replace one person per se, but you...
Yeah. A little bit from everybody.
Yeah, you're right. Then you can... I definitely agree that, okay, like, when you count the net time saved, there are times where the model can fix bugs that, like, would have cost me, like, one day. Right? One day is huge.
Right.
And these things are definitely, like, if you... I don't know whether anybody has done any, like, real, like, metric evaluation or these type of things, but if you use time as a real metric and then not as in number of... Okay, maybe 3 hours, like, kind of metric, right? But these things are not, like going to replace one person as it is, but more like a passive aura that buffs everybody. Mm. The in-game terms, right?
Yeah. I often think of myself as a bard because I tell stories and I plus everybody around me. You know, like that's an ideal situation for me in a D&D group.
Oh, okay. Yeah. No, I don't play D&D, but okay. Yeah, I said,
they're the kings of passive aura.
Support hero.
Support, yes. Yeah, okay. AI support, I think, is very encouraging. I think, like, where is it still not working for you? That you've tried and you're like, oh man, I expected it to be better.
Oh, there are times when models try to get lazy and try to fix something they are still...
We will have...
They get lazy and then they try to, like, gaslight me into thinking that, like, the bug is fixed.
Ah.
So there are classes of problems that are, like, very easy for the model and very hard for humans. There are some things that are very easy for humans, very hard for model.
More of X paradox.
And stuff. So it's still very hard to characterize these things into these proper quadrants and stuff like that. So I would say that the capabilities of models these days are good enough to be, like, really helpful. But, like, it still has some... But yeah, but I think this will... Like, this, I don't think there's anything that to be done to specifically, like, focus fire. And these things is more like... general capability improvements, the model just get better over time and then these things will just, like, go away.
You say that, okay, so yes, I think obviously in the grand scheme of things, just trust the process, keep scaling in every dimension and things will just fall away, things will emerge. But you've also said in the past, I can't remember the exact tweet, where you're like, each additional data set compounds over time. They're just small additions. And I would say that when you say things like focus fire on things that you would think humans, it's easy for humans, hard for machines. Those are easy wins where you can just add a data set that would focus fire on that. Mm. And isn't hill climbing just a sequence of doing that until you reach AGI?
Okay, so I get your point. I think that it's true that sometimes a lot of progress on the whole is just a series of small incremental changes that push. I think that's accurate. That's true. There's also... It also feels that there's also a lot of, like, small, seemingly minor, for the lack of a better word, like, that push AI to the state where it is today. So I definitely agree. So nothing against people who, like, focus fire, but it's just that when I mean that, like, it might be not easy to focus fire on things that are, like, not very easy to characterize. So it's just that, like, when there's something targeted, right?
Yeah.
Like, okay, I want to improve this capability, add some data. So I think, like, defining, like evals, defining the problems and stuff like that is, like, characterizing it. And if it can be characterized, then okay, then fine. But I think it's like, what I was trying to say with the coding is that these things are not even, some of the class of problems are like, I don't work on coding, but like people maybe work on coding, they know like they have like terminology for different types of failures. But so maybe somewhere somebody is focusing fire on this, then make the model better. That's great for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, that's why it takes 1,000 people to like get all these things together.
AI is definitely like a big collective effort these days. It's a big machine.
Yes, yeah. It's really crazy. Okay, so I just wanted to broaden out to general things people are talking about in the community on research.
Yeah.
Which again, I know that you are very locked in, so you don't necessarily have read all the papers or anything, but we can just riff on ideas.
Okay,
and
yeah,
you can obviously ask me what I think as well.
Yeah.
Is attention all you need?
So attention and transformer is like a core idea in the recent times. Like pre-training and scale is the thing that made attention and transformers like actually shine, right? Because without, I think the first transformer paper was this like a machine translation thing, and then basically GPT and BERT were the ones that like actually showed the full like big potential of this idea. So in terms of, is attention like really, really all we need? Like probably no. But I think it's like one of the, from the architectural point of view, also maybe no. But it's not all you need, but you need it definitely.
What else are you thinking about on that same level? Are you talking about MOE stuff? What do you mean when you say it's not all you need?
Like, you definitely need like the scale of pre-training, you need all the tokens, you need like RL.
I think when people say it's attention you need, it's mostly
from architectural point of view.
Well, will transformers get us all the way to AGI, right? I guess
So basically when you get to AGI, is the
problem. Will it still be a GNOME architecture or like meaningfully different?
You'll be a transformer, I think.
Really?
It depends on what you call it, but I think unless the paradigm shifts completely, which is, I mean, as a scientist, you cannot like completely like, say no to like that this will never happen. But my feeling is that it's been like what, like almost 10 years since Transformer?
2017.
9 years, right, since the Transformer. I think we have not replaced self-attention. Like it's some form of it. Like you could rename it, you could name it something else, you could something else.
You can do local, global,
Yeah, it's still a transformer in the end. And I think like that's not going like anywhere. Unless the whole thing with like backprop, like everything like goes, like the whole thing just changes completely. Like then there's a different story, there's a different conversation to have. But if it's still within the same scope and bounds. So I spent a lot of time thinking about architectures and like whether there's alternate architectures and stuff like that. Okay, at the sequence processing level, like
there is the ultimate sequence to sequence transformer.
It's probably the self-attention is there was this whole big era, which I was also involved in this era, where people try to like undermine the attention as much as possible. Like they try to remove it, simplify it, make it efficient, like this whole like efficient attention era. At the end of the day, the outcome was always like, oh, we remove all attention, but we have one layer of self-attention there and it still works. Like that's at the end like of the like, always the story.
Which even Noam, a character, he published some stuff about how he has some ratio of mixing of local and global attention, right? Like basically still attention, but modifying it quite a lot.
I would consider local and global attention to be like still attention.
Just like how much you're skipping.
Yeah. The only question is that if the formulation changes too much, your QKV becomes like ABCDEFG or something like that.
Maybe I'll give you some motivating constraints in order to do this. You guys are still charging 2x for over 180k token context or 240, something like that. And the max is, theoretical max is 2 million tokens, right? What if we need 200 million? Is there some point at which where even this concept of input token context is irrelevant because you are doing continual learning, that kind of stuff, where you're modeling it as, okay, the AGI will be achieved through a sequence-to-sequence transformation. Therefore, an attention is the best sequence-to-sequence model or architecture. Therefore, attention is all you need. But I think other people are like, sequence-to-sequence doesn't accurately capture intelligence.
But that's not really about sequence-to-sequence. That's more about like the whole gradient design and backprop thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not the architecture itself. That's a problem that is more of like the learning paradigm itself rather than the architecture itself. I think the architecture is just basically like the interface between the learning algorithm and the tokens. I think it's more about the learning algorithm itself. And this continual learning, this like there's many ways to think about processing many like insanely large like contexts, right? Like 200 million, 1 billion tokens or something like that, right? Like whether it's going to be like you have a new learning algorithm that every time you run inference, you you learn on it, right? Then you can technically have some kind of memory, like human being is learning as I'm talking to you, right? So that's also like one way. The other way is like whether, okay, maybe somebody will say that, okay, the attention is like just too expensive for 200 million, 1 billion context, so we need new architecture. Or some people will say that, oh, we just improve the chips, like accelerators. So I think many ways to interpret it, but I think it's like, if it's about, there's a lot of fundamental things that, if it's about continual learning and stuff, there's a lot of fundamental things about the learning algorithm and stuff as well, yeah.
That will have to change?
I think like the learning paradigm and architecture and stuff that goes like hand in hand. And I think as the field progress and ideas just stack on top one another, right? So there's also this thing about an idea that was proposed has to be compatible with all the work that have been done before to shine. Right, it's a bit of a variant of this hardware lottery, like by Sarah. It's not the hardware lottery that I wrote about the GPUs failing, but it's the original hardware lottery. But it's more like a bit of lottery of like the things proposed have to play well with the things that were proposed before. So it's a bit like going down this local optic minima to some extent. So now we are like in this local minima of like transformers, everything, right? Maybe it's not easy to like get totally out of this, because also a lot of people's investment and optimizers have been done. So the things that play well need to play well with the ideas before. And the way I see it now is it's very difficult to like come out of it.
Okay, I'm not entirely convinced. I see what you're saying, but let's call it Gen AI. I fucking hate that term. It's still a very young field. And so yes, there's been 8 years of work on the transformer, but what's that in the grand scheme of things? Maybe we're in a local minima and we've got to notch ourselves out of it. I do want to leave that open-ended. I don't have an idea. I do think that people are in, let's call it what Ilya Sutskever has been calling the age of research, right? Like we're like, okay, we scaled up what we can scale up. We know what the next maybe 1-2 orders of magnitude look like in scaling on every dimension that we know about. But what is the next dimension to scale?
There's this like misunderstanding a little bit about like the last 5 years has just been like scaling things, scales.
Oh, okay, please tell me more. Yes, you made that joke about now we scale researcher salaries.
Okay, let's not go there. But I think that ideas like matter, and I think that there have been a lot of good ideas in the last 5 years. It's just that maybe it's just not. So it's not been like blindly, like if you took an MLP, right, just like without a self-attention, and you just, okay, I'm going to throw like $100 trillion on this and scale up that thing and the thing.
It's never going to work.
It's never going to work. Yeah. So there's no, like, there's part of it that's also like, I think the bitter lesson gets used too much in like, too conveniently used around, but actually there's also a little bit of there's also a sweet lesson where it's like, ideas matter. And I think even to today, right, like people downplay ideas and stuff like that. Yeah.
Do you think the rate of new ideas, without being specific about what ideas, because obviously you can't share, but like, do you think the rate of ideas has increased or decreased because there's like kind of a law of diminishing returns? Are they smaller?
I think the number of ideas is always proportional to the number of researchers working on a certain problem. So by definition, it should increase. But I think the number of ideas that actually work is not decreasing compared to the last, like if we're not in the era of diminishing returns yet.
Well,
so I think the ideas are still very important, and there's still very good ideas that are game changers that are being invented.
Yeah. And I think I know the answer to this, but is the closed lab advantage increasing versus open source or decreasing? Like the Chinese labs, they say they keep publishing open source models, and some of the American labs as well publish open source models. Would you say that the ideas that I see there, NVIDIA has Nemotron, OpenAI has GPT-OSS, these are all basically checkpoints on what is publicly known about training models as of this year? You know,
that, okay.
Like, it's declassified information because everyone... everyone does this.
I think that the gap is increasing.
I don't think it's completely predictable from stuff that you said before.
I think the gap is definitely increasing. Yeah.
I think that would make... That justifies... researchers. Otherwise, what's the point of having researchers if not finding new tricks that compound over time? Yeah.
But definitely, I think it's increasing. Yeah.
Okay. I'll do a side tangent. I don't know if you have any comments on this.
Okay.
So then this is very related to NVIDIA's recent purchase of Groq, which I don't know if you have views because you're very TPU-centric, but are we memory or compute bound? And this is relevant to the Transformers discussion of like...
In terms of what? Like serving?
Exactly. I think the classic view is that we're compute bound because we just need more compute for pre-train and RL and then inference.
Yeah.
But actually, the counter argument I would make against this is I actually have this chart of Moore's laws. I wish I could just pull it up easily. Moore's laws of the scaling of compute versus scaling of memory versus scaling of network and bandwidth. And compute has a much higher slope of scaling than the other two.
Memory, really, what, the cheap memory? Yeah. Like, honestly, I don't think about this memory bound that much. So maybe it doesn't. Yeah, so I would disagree with it, but I don't have high confidence in.
And because you're mostly on the research side, less on the inference side.
Yeah,
maybe the inference guys will be like,
oh. Yeah. I don't wake up when I think about serving. So yeah, maybe I don't think about the inference that much. Yeah.
My previous line of discussion here was like, NVIDIA is very foresighted by Mellanox because it actually is the real bottleneck in scaling because it has the lowest Moore's law. And then the second one now is memory, which is very interesting.
Okay. But honestly, I don't think about that much. Yeah.
Understand. Okay, data efficiency. So this is a joke, but implicit in this is that there's some kind of a maximum data exposure, right? And so previously, I would say that a lot of the training paradigms is like one epoch is all you need. That's the meme title of this idea. I would say that the real number maybe is between 3 to 4 epochs. And I do wonder what the theoretical limit of data efficiency of a model in terms of training and compression should be. I don't know what that means.
Data efficiency, and basically, but you're asking the question in a way of asking like how much repeats is tolerable. Is that
one? In tolerable is contingent on does it actually improve in meaningful.
Oh.
It's not about like you actually want to do it for its own sake. But I do think there's that. And then there's also just the sheer amount of stuff that we can learn with limited data. So you say, let's just say like you're not compute bound, you're not memory bound. But let's say you are data bound, right? Last time that we were on the podcast, we talked about chinchilla versus inference optimal training. But now actually, I think a lot of people are even talking about like data optimal training. Like a given limited data set, how well can you learn from it? I think that's an interesting research direction that not enough people are talking about. Maybe it is something that is commonplace in the labs, but it seems very clear that we are very unoptimized with regards to how much we learn from our data. I'll just put it there.
I think in general, the like learning more, like extracting more from every data point is definitely valuable, but I think that also related to the fact that we're like running out of tokens in the world. So I don't work on data for pre-training, and I think things that I say were
general state of industry, not nothing.
The general state of industry, right? So I think that I don't even know whether data has like diverged, like the way that these things are done, it have diverged too much across these labs and
no
open.
There's a lot of cross pollination for sure.
Cross pollination, okay, yeah. But I don't think about data that much, like the pre-training data that much.
Maybe. Earlier the first half of this year, I would have said that kind of pre-training is dead and that everyone's like just funneling all their work towards RL. And we had this like Grok chart, which was very interesting, where we're sending the same amount of compute on screen as to, you think it's a psyop?
No, I don't know. I have no idea, yeah.
I think that people are taking it seriously. They are like, yeah, okay, whatever. Especially in the agent labs like Cognition Cursor, they're taking the open source models from whoever, and then adding, let's call it pre-trained scale RL on top of it, if they have that level of info, which they do, which is very interesting. I would say, this data efficiency argument, I think it's also more trying to discover new paradigms of learning in order to get where we want to all go, which is, and the existence proof is humans, right? Your two-year-old daughter is much more capable than an LLM in some things, having seen way like 8 orders of magnitude less data. That's very interesting.
Comparing human learning and machine learning is definitely like
purely as an existence proof that we could probably do better. 3 examples of dog.
Yeah.
4th example of unidentified animal, I can probably tell it's a dog as a human. But machines, classically, you take 20.
The data efficiency of humans is definitely way higher than models. Yeah, the only question is that where does this thing come from? Is it actually like putting more flocks on every token? Oh, like maybe it's like back to the question about whether the transformer is the optimal architecture. Maybe it's back prop. It's the problem. Yeah. Maybe it's the off policiness. Maybe it's the So what is the like? Where's the bug, right? Where's
exactly,
the bug, right?
Exactly.
But maybe it's a feature, not a bug. I don't know. But
Okay, we've identified the problem. It took me a while to get this across. So this is the kind of data efficiency I'm talking about. I think it's emerging. Basically, at the end of every year, I like try to take bets as to okay, what will be the big themes for next year.
Yeah,
I think there's more of them that people are really trying to focus on. Because you're feeling this data crunch, even though everyone's like still investing in data, I forgot to mention that I would say that I've been wrong on pre-training being dead. Yes, I've now met pre-training leads from both Anthropic and OpenAI, and I've seen the talk from the DeepMind guy recently. And so like, everyone's investing in pre-training still, which is like nice to see.
Nobody said pre-training was dead.
I know. No, it's a theory that we're trying to disprove or prove.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I think, okay, let me wind back to my general idea, right? So yeah, data efficiency seems worthwhile. You would treat it as like, okay, well, show me where the bug is and I'll go fix it.
Yeah.
We don't know where the bug is.
Yeah.
We just have existence proof that it could be better. And then I think the final logical chain in this for me is that everyone is focusing on some idea of world model as a version of this form of more efficient learning, which potentially might not take the form of a sequence-to-sequence transformer. I don't know how that works. Like, definitely a little bit out of my depth here. To me, that is more efficient because every world must be internally consistent. And if the next piece of evidence comes in and invalidates those worlds, then you no longer need to pursue those paths ever. And you can just narrow in on the world that you've identified. And so to me, that is learning, where you're learning to fit world models.
Or to the actual data.
Yes. Yeah. Maybe you can treat the learning process as curve fitting.
Yeah, so you're learning the world instead of learning the world model. Yeah, so you're learning the world model, right? Okay. By sampling multiple world models and then finding out which one fits the data the best.
So I guess my query, is this what people talk about? Is this, obviously feel free to attack it because I'm just spitballing it. But this is what I pick up from talking to multiple people about, okay, what are you talking about with world models? What are you talking about data efficiency and learning efficiency? And like, how do you gel it all together in a cohesive sense of the future where we can
what's the definition of world model at the start, from the start?
Yeah, there are three kinds.
Okay, go on, yeah.
First kind is the VO kind.
VO kind?
Or the, what's the other one? Genie?
Yeah.
That DeepMind has, which is the sort of video world model.
Yeah.
You model everything with some kind of Gaussian splats or whatever, and you like, you inhabit that 3D space.
Yeah.
Second, let's call it the Jan LeCun / Meta school of thought, which I don't know if you're that familiar with it. He has published the JEPA architecture, and then separately, FAIR has also published the code world models, where you're basically, specifically for code, very interesting, you are executing code and modeling the internal state of the execution environment as you go line by line.
Okay.
So the LLM actually like learns to predict those things.
Yeah.
And actually, it seems a lot more efficient at the scale that they've tested it out, which is very cool.
Which definition are you anchoring on?
The third one.
The code world model?
That's the second one.
Oh, second one.
Those two are bundled together.
Yeah, yeah.
The JEPA fans are probably hating me right now because I'm lumping all Meta's work under one school of thought.
Yeah.
But whatever.
Okay.
Okay, so the first one is VO, Genie, if it is like super spatial intelligence, those kind of video-based world models. Second one is some execution or some sort of explicit modeling in the as you sort of run through the corpus.
Yeah.
And then I think the third one is this amorphous thing, which I think people are trying to get to, where they are doing what I said about the resolution of possible worlds and your curve fitting as you learn, as you inference.
Yeah, but what is the world model itself? Is it like...
It is a mental model of where everything is and how you think the world works, what I think you think, like everything.
Okay, but technically, it's like...
It is something in the latent space.
Okay. So you can, for simplicity, it could be just be like a transformer model between and...
Yes. And stuff. So like, to me, that is the most coherent thing to the current paradigm, which is you could actually do this in current transformers. I think the way that you train it will probably have to be different.
Okay. I see.
I don't have any conclusion here. I'm just throwing it out as something where I know you're interested in this kind of stuff and I don't have that many knowledgeable people to talk to about it.
No, I don't think about world models that often. I think because world models are just not really well defined in the first place.
Yeah.
But I think...
So don't say on world models, but the problem is learning efficiency and maybe, I guess, accuracy or like AGI capability that is not easily unlocked right now on our current path of scaling.
Yeah. So I think when it comes to like data efficiency, I think it's more like I'm a believer of finding ways to spend more flops per token, right? Because you actually, basically, if you are data bound, you want higher data efficiency because you can learn more from every data point, squeeze out more points, right? So things like that can extract more, can use more flops on every token is definitely like a form of data efficiency. Then there's the learning algorithm, right? Because I think there's a different scaling law for like humans is this, machine is this, and like dogs are this, cats are this, and there's this different...
Like exponent, right. The Ilya chart.
Right, yeah. There's this famous chart. And point one and point two are just like not entirely like the different things, because it could be that better architecture is actually just spending more flops per token. So if you come to a point where you are very data bound but not compute bound at all, you just find algorithms that spend a lot of compute on every token. So I think the overarching point is just that, okay, that is a learning algorithm thing for data efficiency. And then if whether the correct way is actually just to apply more flops per token, just to squeeze out more from every data point. Also, because humans actually don't like they are exposed less. When you say less or more data, it's also very ambiguous because they are technically like on 24/7, and then you have
things mostly visual.
Yeah. Have a lot of like different types of inputs, right? And whether they actually spend more flops on everything they listen is also a question, because maybe they are just data efficient just because, I mean, somebody needs to count like how much flops the brain used to process, like how much, maybe they're just spending more compute on every token. And also maybe the learning algorithm is different. So, but I agree that data efficiency is very important given that I think we're going to like, there's limited amount of data in the world.
One more thing before we go into DSI. You know how like we're talking about RL and like you're working on RL stuff. Why are people paying so much for RL environments?
Wait, so who is paying for RL environments?
OpenAI and Anthropic, at least. Nobody said anything about DeepMind. So a lot of the model labs that are not you are well known for paying at least seven figures for external startups to create RL environments for them to train in.
Okay.
And then I think the question is, if you are... your models are so good at coding, why don't you do it yourself? And so I think there's some amount of expertise that's being distilled from human experts into an RL environment that you can then let your agents run wild in. But I'm curious if there's any other deeper insight than that, because I'm not satisfied with my own explanation.
RL environments that are like, that have a lot of domain expertise are probably very valuable. And actually, I don't know specifically about what RL environments people are actually especially buying. But what was the thing that you're not satisfied by? Like the...
It was so valuable. And a lot of people are saying like, look, it's a Next.js app inside of a Docker container that logs stuff out when you send inputs in. And then you could probably do it yourself internally, right? Why you pay so much for some startup that you don't know to do it for you?
I have no clue about why this is happening. Yeah, I have no clue.
And a classic example would be like, if you want to build a computer use agent for buying things in e-commerce, you would want our environments that perfectly replicate maybe the top 1,000 e-commerce websites.
Yeah.
And then you just parallel roll out on all of them. Does that seem valuable?
I don't know.
All right, cool. DSI and LLM Rexis. A big bet for me this year for my conference was we actually like started focusing on LLM Rexis.
What's the motivation behind starting LLM Rexis?
Track.
Yeah.
I think Rexis is the king AI problem in consumer. It is the single most valuable thing. All your feeds, even search is Rexis.
Yeah. Basically, it's search, basically. Like it's a retrieval.
It's the god problem. Right, because Rexis is ranking, but then also filtering, also personalization, yep. Also re-indexing and like performance. It is the god problem, and you get paid a lot for it. Engineers are not that excited by it, which is very weird, because they don't see a lot of them don't work on Rexis, and they probably never will.
Yeah,
but they don't see the monetary value that can come out of a good Rexis. The other two pieces of updates for me, which I actually didn't even know that DSI like directly tied into this, was one, Twitter publicly adopted their feed algorithm as an LLM Rexis.
LLMs are just used everywhere now, but whether it's actually like a...
big LLM.
Like whether it's like a generative retrieval type of model, like it's like another question.
Correct.
Is it?
We don't know. All we know is that they have said that they have swapped out their current Rexis for an LLM-based Rexis. That's all they've
published. Okay.
But what is published is YouTube where they actually adopted semantic IDs for YouTube's Rexis.
Yeah.
And YouTube is obviously a big deal.
Is it like public information?
Yes.
Okay, okay.
They came and did talk about it with us.
Okay.
And then they published a V2 this year as well.
Okay, I see.
More info. And I just thought, so basically, the last time you were on the podcast, we didn't talk about DSI that much. But you have actually some background in IR. You care about IR.
No, I don't care about IR, but I think DSI, okay, like DSI or generative retrieval was like, I think one of my favorite works in the all of like, I have some IR background in like when I was doing a PhD, I did some Rexis work. I did some retrieval work with Rexis and stuff like that. So I have some IR and Rexis background. So I think generative retrieval and generative Rexis is very conflated. DSI started as a retrieval thing. So we did like natural questions, like ranking of like documents and everything. It started off as, I mean, we did an interview with Yannick, like me and Don, we did an interview with Yannick when the paper came out like long time ago. So at that time, we wanted to like reimagine retrieval and search. So we wanted, at that time, LLM, we were still using T5 models. At that time, it was like we're not in the LLM era yet. It was pre-LLM era. It was like, okay, pre-training works kind of thing. And then there were like some pre-training models around. So we wanted to reimagine retrieval, right? But retrieval Rexis, they're all the same formulation ranking retrieval problem, right? And then that's where we started to imagine retrieval as one giant RAM that encodes everything in the memory. We tried so many different, like semantic ideas. Actually, my collaborator Vin was the one that came up with either semantic ideas that basically, at the start of this whole generative retrieval was actually basically literally just trying to give a document like identifier and just predicting like raw brute force predicting like this. It actually works. It actually works because the models can memorize something. If you look at the literature from all the way to things like doc to vec, it's very off, like model, the words have no meaning. They're just ID in the vocab, right? It's just a number, right? And technically the models have enough capacity to predict. But I think semantic IDs was an idea that basically you have some like semantic association and then you actually try to break down the search space hierarchically, right? So how this would evolve into Rexis was at that time after DSI came out, right? So at Cheese Group and Mahesh, the guy who they did some exploration of applying DSI to Rexis, and that's how that generative Rexis recommender system paper came out.
Yeah, I didn't even know he was involved. It's crazy.
That was like basically us like transferring this, like basically, okay, DSI works, we try to try it on Rexis. And then I think the recommender system people have a slightly different way of doing semantic IDs, but it's basically just because the domain is slightly different. But after that, I think we were done with the invention part. Anyway, this one.
The rest is details.
The rest are details. So over time, I also left Google and stuff like, so over time, these things evolve a little bit here every day. I think I also saw like something like Spotify is also using something like YouTube Spotify. Like they use this type of like semantic IDs, this type of DSI like models. I think from the research community point of view, like the DSI work was the first one that like decodes semantic tokens. But then when we went to, I don't know, academic community is like strange in a way that like they will do things like, oh, this is generative retrieval, it's not generative Rexis. It's like they will do this kind of like random things that is like a bit strange. But yeah, anyway, this was like the whole history of this generative retrieval. Apparently there's also a lot like of people working on, I don't follow Edis at all now. It's just not even in my mind. But yeah. There was once I went to, even in the Singapore office, there are Swiss actually like working on generative retrieval. They don't work on, I don't know whether they're still working on it, but I met a person that tried to explain generative retrieval to me. It was quite funny that, you know, I kind of like co-invented generative retrieval. But yeah, I think this whole IR thing has been, it's just an interesting phase. And I definitely think DSI is one of my more creative works that I've done. That is not like really LM, but it's like
under the general principle of apply ML to everything. If the Googler is working on generative retrieval, would that be like AI overviews? Is that something similar?
I have no idea.
Okay. For people listening, I did have a track there. I think you just type in AI.engineer and you'll get it, where the Gemini guy was talking. Sorry, the YouTube guy was talking about how to use Gemini for the Rexis. I don't know what size of Gemini, because he didn't talk about it. But this is public work now. And basically, every YouTube video uploaded gets encoded into some kind of code book, and they retrain this every day on some kind of batch job. Yeah, just interesting. So yeah, I don't know if you even know what Gemini is being used for.
I don't follow like this. These days.
I do think like in the sense of like for people who are not still not getting it, applying intelligence and the general intelligence of an LLM to the recommendation task means you can accommodate such weird recommendations, like such weird queries as well, that normally like no classical system can ever handle. And I think like it's also somewhat emergent in a sense that when you were using T5, you just couldn't actually add that much value on top of a normal BM25 retrieval technique. Would you say that's accurate? It's not just about paraphrasing. It is about understanding query intent.
BM25 is a really strong baseline, actually. BM25 is a really strong baseline, yeah.
I don't know the comparative delta versus T5 for you guys versus BM25, but I don't expect it to be very high, and I expect it to be a lot higher for a true LLM based Rexis, depending obviously on the query set.
I didn't really think about it this way before, but because I've done modeling in many different domains, including like search, and you know, in the search community, there's also set of benchmarks and stuff like that for like that people who climb on there's some like. There's Amy of I don't know what is it called these days anymore, but generally the modeling dynamics of IR tasks is very different from like Rexis tasks. It's very different from standard language tasks or like vision tasks and something like when we kill climb L and when you train models and like the way that modeling things interact with this environment is very different. So I think that I honestly hated working on like Rexis and retrieval stuff. Okay, I'm just talking about old days. When you work on like T5, you change architecture, you try to improve perplexity, you use super glue, like this is olden days era. On like even now when you train LLMs, you just do zero shot, two shot stuff like that. Your things, because as a researcher engineer, you just interact with the environment a lot by this, you're just like, okay, RL by this environment. But Rexis and IR has a very strange feeling to it. Strange feeling in the sense that it feels like whatever works, it's like you are in a world with the gravity is different, or like you are in a world where the modeling things that feel intuitive are not intuitive. So it feels like a very strange space to. So I wrote some papers back in my days on like Rexis and stuff like that. Every time I ran some modeling experiments for Rexis and stuff like that, I didn't enjoy the. It feels like the environment was rude. It feels like the vibes are just like.
What makes it rude?
It just feels
transactional.
No, not transactional. Like I don't know how to describe it. For example, like if you play like sports, like play tennis, badminton, when you hit the ball, you have a very nice feeling like hitting the sweet spot. When you do modeling in traditional domain, when you get the feedback back, you feel like everything sounds right, everything feels right, everything right. But Rexis and IR is like a problem where it's like you hit the shuttlecock and you hear a glass shatter like randomly. It just feels this weird world that. That
cause and effect are too far apart.
Like it just feels strange. And then sometimes maybe the metric, like I think Rexis they use like all the NCCG effects. And then the BM25 is strong, and then you this, and then you get like worse than the BM35. Back in the day where you stack 2 LSTM to 3 LSTM, you're like, whoa, I see like it's just the game.
An unrewarding area to work in.
It's just weird. Also the IR community and the retriever community is also like always behind the mainstream, and then now it's just probably going even more worse because of LLM and stuff. So okay, I'm getting into hot take territory, but it's just like certain conferences are just like behind Neurips and ICML and stuff. Yeah, some conferences are just like they're just like applying things that
they're downstream of.
They're downstream.
Okay.
So it always feels very uninspiring to work on this.
Yeah, look, there's a reason that you left, and
but it was like a side quest, like where I work on it as a side quest thing. Yeah.
Okay, I understand. I still think it's an important business problem, even though maybe it's an unrewarding field.
I can't understand why. Because the academic benchmarks for those tasks are just so far detached from.
Yeah.
They're so far detached from what industry is. I didn't work on any of these, the thing. But that's from an academic point of view.
Oh, then all you need are online evals, right? Yeah, D-test and go. Ooh, okay.
That would have been a different experience, yeah.
That is mostly our sort of topic, research topics, coverage and everything. I think we're just going to end on a very simple one on GDM Singapore. You organize a symposium here. We brought Jeff Dean, Kwok and all the others. Basically, what's the general message or the impetus for starting GDM Singapore?
So we'll talk about the event first. So the event was mostly, so Kwok and I are going to start a team. And then I think before I came back, we discussed this for some time. Jeff was very supportive of this. He was in the region many times in Vietnam and Singapore around the time where I was going to come back. And I think that, so this event itself was Kwok and Jeff were visiting, and we just inspired the community here. I think that it's also a bit more like a soft like setting the tone right for the start of the Gemini team in Singapore. And I think it's a very rare instance where you get somebody like Jeff and Kwok, who are the true pioneers of AI in the world, to be in one room. And then, are you there as well? And I think like many people told me,
not a true pioneer of AI, but okay. I was there to live tweet.
Yeah. I think having them all in one room and then giving these talks, like many people came out to me and said they were very inspired by their presence in the region. So starting a team and starting something is also very, like there's also no one moment that it's not, okay, I press the button and it starts, right? It's like a process, right? So we hire people and then people join one by one and stuff, something like that, right? So I think this event was more, I would say, like to set the vibe. I think it's possible for Singapore to be close to the frontier. And I think that we're having the true pioneers of AI here, we want to give this, basically more like an inspiring thing. And also get left for Kwok and Jeff to meet the people here. And so Jeff was here last year, but Kwok hasn't been here for some time and he's going to have a team here. So it's like also nice to bring him around and meet the people here.
Yeah.
So it was a really like amazing event. We met Long as well. And
who a lot of people don't know has a CS degree. It's like one of the few PMs with a CS degree.
Yeah. I would say that the context of the meeting was more like partially like also he wanted to learn more about the IMO stuff.
Oh, really?
And then also about Jeff. He wanted,
oh, because they invited you without knowing that these guys were coming or something like that.
I was a bit like some, yeah, Jeff and Kwok and me, where we went to visit the chat with at the Istana. And we discussed a little bit on Deep Thing, discussed a bit on IMO. And then I think the rest of it was more like Jeff and Lee Hsien Loong was talking more about, like, it became less about AI and tech, more about very macro, economical, political thing. Which was, I was very out of element with, so I just...
You were in a suit.
I was just talking about the Deep Thing and the IMO and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But he seemed genuinely quite surprised that AI has reached this point. So I think, but it was an interesting...
I would say for people, like, you have done something that is unique in Singapore's history so far. You're establishing a frontier research lab in Singapore, which is an accomplishment. I think the other thing also that I guess I'm still trying to wrap my head around is, does geography actually matter? Like, you're all working on a team, you have your London people, you have your Mountain View people, and mostly you're just, like, collaborating with them anyway. You've collaborated with them your whole life. I don't even really know what countries mean anymore when it comes to research or just AI in general, because this thing is just inherently international from the start.
This is a very good like question. Also, it's related to the thing about identity, right? Because I think you also moved from SF and Singapore quite a bit, right? I was in like Mountain View this like 1-2 weeks ago, and like I'm here, but like almost all my if you just look at my siblings, aside from my family, like everybody I talk to is like somehow in the Bay Area or like this because of work and everything. I think the geography matters. Okay, firstly, the most like thing is like logistical is like probably the time zone.
So you literally want the 24-hour coverage around the world.
No, there are advantage. No, what I'm saying is that the difference is possibly like it's also more like people define the location more than the location define.
Okay.
The people somehow. Okay, the time zone, you get to the time zone a little bit like there are pros and cons. I think there's pros and cons, right?
So you're bullish on Asia, Singapore people, the talent pool.
I think we managed to find like really amazing people. But I also have to say that this type of things is more like talent attract talent. I think most of the time, like people are very excited. Like the vibe I get is that people are very excited because it's like Kwok's team and my team and we're working on like very core things related to AGI. So I feel like the talent we can get from the region is really, really good. But it's only because it's us that we can unlock this talent. Otherwise, might join some other place.
Yes, and move to the US.
Yeah. About the identity-wise, I would say that I definitely agree with you that, like, why does it matter? Like, that, I think that the advantages of Singapore itself or, like, just anywhere, like, it's also that you are, like, okay, the world is very global, so technically you can interact as much as you want. You can also go there. But I think Singapore has this advantage where you can go close and you can go far. I think the Bay Area is like so much about... I have friends in London and New York that would just never move to the Bay Area. So I'm not against Bay Area. I think Bay Area is a great place, right? But it's just AI everywhere, right? I think sometimes if you have some like mental space and energy to like to have some other culture, and then like, you know, like London, Singapore, New York, they have their own culture, right? But the Bay Area culture is this like AI, right? Like you just go anywhere, you just hear AI everywhere, right? Even the billboards and stuff like
that. You can get a bit much.
Yeah.
Although I did see some billboards down here.
Oh, AI also?
Yeah. No, I was like, what is this?
It's
culture infecting Singapore.
I do think that to some extent, if you want to do research in, you need a little bit of peace and quiet somewhere, right? So this island may be good for that, but then you can, we're still like able to like be connected, right?
Okay.
So I think that's mainly, talent-wise, I think people are strong here. Yeah.
So far enough away, but you're still connected. You have strong talent. What are you hiring for? You're still hiring, right?
We're hiring like my team will work on like RL and reasoning for Gemini and Gemini Deep Thing. I think we care more about like talent density now. So we're not like also like growing that big, this small team first. Just because compute per capita is probably like important. And yeah, so I think that's something that we're hiring for now. Basically, I personally, there's a lot of DNs, but I think like generally, there's a lot of people like who are very capable. But I think what I'm looking for mainly is either you have like a track record of RL research or like some, even not necessarily the RL, but or like some exceptional achievement in like coding competitions or like some exceptional achievement somewhere, then that's like the kind of people that we want.
Yeah, because you don't strictly require, I do remember something about your record days where you're like, you like to train your own trainers from scratch, right? So they don't.
I forgot if I said that or not, but to some extent, to some extent, yeah, I think we'll definitely be very happy with people that are like very high stats and just like even without much
statistical knowledge.
No, stats.
Yeah, yeah.
The stat points.
Child with int.
Like just high tech stat points people, like just raw
IQ, yeah.
High talent people like this. I think all like strong engineering skills, ML can be learned easily, the knowledge can be learned easily.
Yeah, I think maybe one version of this is, can it be done on a student budget? Can you do something interesting anymore on a student budget? I would say relevant to the point where conferences are quieter these days. I did do an interview with one of the best paper winners where they worked on 1,000-layer neural network RL. And that was done on a student budget. It was very cleanly executed pieces and paper and in good findings. Look, I'm not sure if production models will ever go to 1,000 layers, but they stretched it in an interesting direction and found some good recommendations. And the guy immediately got hired by OpenAI. And I think that's encouraging for the grad students in the market who are like, okay, well, do I need to know somebody who works at these labs in order to get in? My uncle works there. I get the internship or whatever. No, actually, you can just do it on a student budget with good advisors.
Oh, I actually think one thing interesting is that for most of the people that I actually went to recruit them like personally, like, right? So you see their work and then you send them DMs, right? So I get a lot of
DMs. For the best paper?
No. Like for hiring generally. Oh. So generally, I almost, like, and to your point, it's like you almost like you can just do good work, put it online, and then somebody will contact you, right? It's actually super easy, but super hard at the same time because...
I can tell you, like, I talked to a few of these grad students, they don't know what good work means, right? Because they don't know... There's so many things that their professors have the agenda they're forcing on them, which like may not be right because it's not like their professors know what to work on either. So yeah, they just need guidance. They just need, hey, work on these like 5 things. Show me an interesting result in any of them.
Okay, so if somebody comes up with something and then does something that you feel that is very tasteful and aligns with what like researchers in the labs like want, and they come up with that independently, you know that the function that produces it is good, right? Like if you just go and tell somebody to do this, like you just get the signal that this guy can execute, right? So I think there's some value in people that...
Yeah, they demonstrate taste, research taste.
Yeah, research taste.
Yeah. Very interesting. I feel like I could give people... Yeah, I do care about this. In some ways, the research directions work that I do is a little bit of that. Like it's low accountability for me because obviously it's just thought experiments. But I think for a lot of people, it's like their career is... bounded by, can you demonstrate research taste with this like short 3-4 years that you have and just do it? Yeah.
Yeah, I would say that this is, it's more, there's so much competition just because of like the, like everybody wants to get into AI. It's just more of like how to, like mostly it's more like how you're going to prove yourself that you're right? Yeah. It must be hard these days to be a grad student trying to prove yourself. It's definitely harder, but yeah.
Yeah, not your job. Okay, that was it. Do you have any other sort of rants or topics that you had queued up before we wrap?
And I don't, yeah, but it was great. Yeah, it was, I had a great time.
It was fun chatting, man.
Fun chatting.
Yeah, I even love, last time we meet at the symposium, we were supposed to record, but even we just ended up hanging out and chatting. It's just nice to get the brain dump of what's going on in your world. Because, yeah, we're working on really important stuff, man.
Always great to chat with you and see you. Yeah.
Good to chat. Parting words on the sort of weight loss and workout journey, because that's also a big thing for you.
I think being healthy is important to do good research. Right. And I think I've been probably in in the peak physical health now.
Yeah, you look great.
Yeah, thanks. And I think it's also impacted my work in a good way.
You did the sort of Kapati inspired like biohacking.
I didn't go so extreme, but I was like also quite data driven when I came. I will like have my own eval and I will track this. I'm still supposed to make a blog post about this, but I feel like I'm not like really at the end game yet. So like when I get there, just for people who don't know, I think I lost 23 kilos
this year.
Actually, across 1 year.
Yeah.
1.5 years.
Yeah.
So 23.
Yeah, basically, literally from the last podcast to now.
Yes, there's an ablation study now. 23 kilos, yeah. And I think like my HRV, heart rate variability, has went up by two times. And my resting heart rate has dropped by 30 beats per minute.
30 beats per minute?
Like it was like 80, 90, and now it's like 60.
Oh, yeah, 80, 90 is super high.
I was unhealthy, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think...
And like when it's hard, like what do you have a thing that kept you going, you know? A lot of people, they're focused on AI, and including myself, right? I do prioritize work. I enjoy work. I don't enjoy the fitness side, but it feeds in to your intellectual work, like the sort of log off and go for a walk, eat better, all that kind of stuff. It feeds in, but like people seeing a positive example like you, they will get inspired to do the same thing. So I think it is good to set yourself up as an example.
I think definitely helps. Like when I do these things for my health, I just think that it's also part of work because it helps me to get better at my job. Yeah. So it's important as well. I think it's important as well.
Yeah. I like that your HRV off the bat. I have no idea what mine is, but yeah. There's a general question about what is productivity and how do you measure it? What really matters? And it's still unclear to me, but I do think general energy level and hunger almost, like you almost have to like experience physical hunger in order to have intellectual hunger. And I don't know if that's like a thing.
No, when I'm hungry, I just think of food. So, I think to me, it's like these disjoint things. But it's hard to do work when you're hungry. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks. It's really great. Yeah, have a great time.